The conclusion that I want to get to for physicists here is something that many of you know very well. So I'm talking about neutrinos from the Earth, geoneutrinos. And so there are several areas of applied neutrinos that have been developing over the last decade or so. And this is one of them where we can do, we're talking about doing geology with neutrinos. And not much in the way of neutrino physics, but maybe a tiny bit. The other thing is detection and monitoring of reactors and so on. But it's nice to be able to cite to the funding agencies that we can, neutrinos are actually good for something that somebody can make a buck off of. But at any rate, the Earth below a few kilometers is very ill known, and I'll explain a little bit more about that. We, basically, what we know is just from seismology. And the velocity of sound measures the density, if you know the equation of state, which you maybe know. And so you get the density, but you don't get the composition. And it is also true, if some of you attended some of these, I guess probably the people here have not, those maybe some of you locals might have, the geological meetings that have been had here, that they don't even really understand the magnetic field on the Earth, the source of the magnetic field, and what's powering it is not well known. Neutrinos, because they fly through the Earth, even at these low energies with very little effect from MSW and so on, give us the chance to see what's going on inside of the Earth. People, you may also have heard, people have talked about at very high energies looking for the atmospheric neutrinos going through the Earth to image the core of the Earth in transmission and effects on the beam. That also will come along with time, but doesn't seem to have enough resolution to teach us much more than we already know. And the biggest point in getting this thing started is the business about who's going to pay for it. And some of my friends in the geology business, in particular Bill McDonough from the University of Maryland, has been Johnny Neutrino Seed of in geology. He's a geologist and author of the main model of the composition of the Earth. He's been going around the world giving neutrino talks to geologists all over, and has actually stirred up some enthusiasm among some. Not that they're ready to plunk down $100 million for a nice big detector yet, but they're coming along. And the thing is, this is one of those funny interdisciplinary areas. The geologists will never build a neutrino detector on their own. They don't bloody know how. But they can learn how. And it'll take physicists and geologists to get into this business working together. So we have to build some kind of a coalition. And you know how hard that is to do. So now I have to go back, and I'm going to draw pictures on the board for a little bit. But I'll just put that up. Okay, so this is, I lifted these slides from Bill. He gave a talk at NASA Goddard just recently, and this was paper and work that he did. And you can see some of the main players that are involved in stirring up the neutrino business. And it actually all got started in Hawaii in a serious way. Darn it, 2004, I think it was, Sandeep, do you remember? We had this meeting where we got together a lot of the big shots in geology and a bunch of us physicists, and had the first really joint meeting. It was very exciting, and there were lots of interesting things, getting geologists talking to physicists, and one thing that came up a little aside was the geologists talking about the CMB, and the physicists are all looking at each other, CMB? And it's the core mantle boundary, it turns out. So we had these little confusions of acronyms every once in a while. That one had us all, gave us all a good laugh. What the hell are they talking about the CMB for? So, yeah. So I'll draw some pictures on the board too. So the Earth, as is pictured there, to remember it, you can sort of take it to be this way, where this is the mantle, and this is the outer core and the inner core. And the inner core is expected to be solid, the outer core more or less liquid, and in fact, the calculated viscosity in this outer core, which is mostly iron-nickel, almost surely, is calculated to be about the viscosity of water. So that's pretty hard to imagine, iron, the viscosity of water. And so it can flow, and it does flow around. It surely makes all kinds of turbulent flow around in here, and it's doing whatever it's doing. And in the core, it's crystallized out. And then out here in the mantle, and then there's the crust on top of the mantle.
But why is the inner core supposed to be crystallized?
Because it's cooled down enough, under enough pressure, if you look in the phase diagram, that it can become solid.
Yeah,
and indeed, one of the...
Write down the thickness of those components.
Well, they're more or less to scale. It's right there. It's to scale right on the board, if you want to look at it. But I always remember the sort of half and half.
Okay.
And so then there's also, this is the CMB here. You guys have all been looking in the wrong direction. So there's crystallization going on around here, and there's the heat of crystallization being liberated. And so that's one of the sources of heat in the Earth. There are many sources that us older folks heard about when we were students about what could be causing the heat in the Earth. And there are things like tidal heating from the moon, the flexing of the Earth. Turns out that's now generally everybody accepts that that's relatively trivial. I do have a slide about that. And there's the secular cooling from the beginning of the Earth. Maybe I better start to use some of the slides. I'll go through them a little bit. But basically, the Earth has mostly cooled off. Now, the Earth, if it was cooling off just by thermal diffusion of the heat to the surface, it wouldn't be cooled off at all. We'd be sitting on a molten pile here. So there has to have been some elevator transport. And then there's argument about how that got the heat out, but it did get the heat out. Witness the fact that this is mostly a pretty solid Earth with this very thin crust. This stuff here is mostly silicates. So the model of the Earth that we mainly use is called the BSE model, another acronym for you to remember, the Bulk Silicate Earth model. And it is something that's largely agreed upon by all geologists, and I have to tell you that there's a good deal of judgment applied in the game of figuring this out. I sort of think of geology as a house which is a few toothpicks holding together some areas that are pretty well motivated and solid. You know, where they've got ratios of isotopes and done some nicely quantitative stuff. And then there's a lot of guesses in between and just so stories about how it fits together. And with some of my geologist friends, we have asked them, well, we're trying to make a model. Can you tell me what is the error on this percentage of the composition? And saying, well, I'd be really surprised if it's more than 20%. But where did you get that number? Well, I'd be really surprised. Jeez, guys. But a lot of this stuff is very complicated, and the boundary conditions are not well nailed down. The sources for what we think are the primitive composition of the Earth are the following. We can dig up some rock here on the surface of the Earth, and look at that. That's great. But you know very well that that's not representative of the whole. You can look at, do spectroscopy of the sun and look at the composition there. and the composition there is quite good, you'll have a lot of hydrogen and helium, as indeed there's a lot of hydrogen and helium in the universe, but not so much right here. So you have to compensate for the volatiles, which have gone bye-bye when the Earth coagulated out of the presumed disk of accretion material, which you probably saw in the press the other day, the first time our astronomer friends have imaged a solar system where they have seen the disk, accretion disk in action, a solar system in formation. And there's much arguing in the planetary physics community about how the planets form, and for instance, some of the things they've observed in looking for external planets is finding inner planets that are like Jupiter's, that are gas planets, but very close into the star. And the way they observed them was they were just tearing around the star. Otherwise, they wouldn't have caught them early on. And they don't understand. That has upset the models of planetary formation. At any rate, we have what we have. Question is, what was the composition, the primordial composition? Well, the first guess you would come up with is, let's look at the meteorites coming in. They must be the same, probably the same junk that formed the Earth, and that is indeed what people use. And then there's much study. Maybe I better show some of the slides to show you some of these. So as I say, these are various people. Steve Dye, my colleague in Hawaii, has worked a lot on this. Fabio Mantovani in Italy has worked a lot on this area as well. So we made, I'll just take these as I come across them. We made the first observation of geoneutrinos in 2005 in Camland. People talking about the time it takes from theoretical hypothesis to experimental recognition. It was 39 years from when people were proposing neutrinos from the Earth. Let's measure them until we finally got the sensitivity to measure them. They are, just to remind you, Nui bars. These are Nui bars coming from the Earth. Largely, there are some Nui's, but mostly it's Nui bars from beta decay. And beta decay of the various long-lived isotopes in the Earth. The Earth is 4.124 billion years old, and they actually know that last decimal point. It used to be 4.123 billion years old, and they just have revised it to 4.124. So that is just, to me, amazing that we have that kind of precision of understanding of the age of the Earth, all from games with isotopes. So at any rate, we made that first measurement, and we got a cover in Nature from it. And Borodino sees the geoneutrinos as well. Borodino is a lot smaller than Camland, but Borodino is a lot cleaner than Camland. And there are no nuclear reactor power plants in Italy, so they don't have the big background of nuclear power plants. Of course, neither does Camland anymore. The background reactors for Camland are nearest ones are in Korea, and they're about 1 or 2% of the flux from the Japanese reactors, which are all shut down now.
So just to have an idea, how many were those in total, neutrinos?
I'll show you that in a second. It's hundreds. Okay, plate tectonics. So the story that I want to get to in the end is that neutrinos are going to help us measure the sources of heating in the Earth where they are and how they're distributed in the Earth. And those very thermal sources are the engine that drives the motion of the magma and all of geodynamics, namely the rising of the mid-ocean ridges and continental drift, that at least when I was a kid, they didn't believe in continental drift. It took the geologists 50 years to recognize that Africa and South America fit together. And actually believe that the continents could move and do move. And so here's a question for you here. How many people here know how old the bottom of the ocean is? So you know that the Earth is 4-point-something billion years old, and the continents are many billions of years old. The bottom of the ocean, except for some isolated patches, is no more than 250 million years old. What?
What was that before 250 million?
It was the magic carpet. The magic carpet here has apparently been going ka-chung, ka-chung, ka-chung. So we're sitting on this very strange machinery that's moving around on the bottom of the ocean. So the bottom of the ocean is extremely young. It's the of the order of the age since the dinosaurs. Very bizarre. So that's why you see these pictures of people recomposing the continents and so on. Take a look at what the date they put on those. They don't put date 4 billion years ago. Oh no, because we don't know. We only know a few hundred million years ago. So there is this cycle, and then there's much debate about this cycle. See, this is going under the continents and going down, and the mid-ocean ridges, principally up the middle of the Atlantic, where you see the mid-ocean ridge. And that was discovered in the 60s. They got cores and got magnetic field from those cores, and they saw the cores as they moved off the ridge, the magnetic field changing, and they could date them, and they could see that they were moving out steadily.
And where in Atlantic?
Maybe I'll have a map of it. It's okay. Pretty much up the middle of the Atlantic.
Okay.
But it's kind of crooked, and it ends at Iceland up at the top. And that's a picture of the Earth's magnetic field, which is a big mess. You always think of it as a dipole. Many people model it as more like 4 dipoles, and we don't even know, and it is also changing. And it is apparently just a spin-off magnetic field from what's going on inside the core, where that field may be very much stronger. So the abundance of the heat-producing elements are mainly from potassium, thorium, and uranium decay chains, not just those elements. And in the bulk silicate earth, the estimates are anywhere from 9 to 36 terawatts. So get used to thinking in terawatts. So give you some energy scale. Big nuclear reactors are like 2 to 4 gigawatts. And there's order of 500 nuclear reactors on Earth. So there's order of terawatt in nuclear reactors, but the Earth's natural radioactivity, the heat from that, not the neutrinos, but the heat from that, is thought to be in total more like 45 terawatts or so. And of that, the estimates from the radioactive decays are somewhere between 9 and 36, and lots of questions about where it resides. So, this also, of course, contains, this was a talk by Bill to people at NASA, but geologists, so there's a lot of geologist stuff in here. So, constrains the chondritic earth models. What are chondrites? Chondrites are these meteors that have these little chondrules in them, the little tiny crystals. And you see pictures of sliced and polished meteorites. They have these beautiful little colored things in them. That's what those are. And they don't look like regular rocks. If you ever were collecting rocks and should slice them open, you'd see a meteorite immediately. But there are many kinds of meteorites. And the ones that the gang likes best are carbonaceous chondrites type C1, of which there are something like 4, and of which the main composition comes from mainly one particular meteorite that everybody loves, that they think is most representative of the primitive Earth. So, right, I already said that, blah, blah, blah. Is the mantle compositionally layered, or does it have large structures? This is actually a huge topic in geology, and fraught with people really shouting at each other over arguments about it. There are those that think that there are at least two layers in the mantle, and some people even more. There are structures such as the hot spots that we owe our place of abode in Hawaii to, the hot spot that moves around and is a column of rising magma that leaves ocean basalt where the islands are. And people argue still about how deep is the root of that tree. Does that just go down a few hundred kilometers? Does it go all the way down to the CMB? And that, believe it or not, that is still a hot fight. Some people down at Caltech have been fighting the battle against that for a long time. I think most of the community thinks that it actually does go, the roots are way down. There are a few hot spots around the world. Iceland is at one of them. And by the way, there are just tremendous new flows that I saw in the news of lava going on in Iceland right now.
So these magmas are like a few thousand kilometers going all the time?
Well, yeah, more or less on a geological scale all the time, on our scale coming and going, and with no decent prediction of when they're coming and going. And things are complicated, like the hot spot in Hawaii. Is the hot spot moving, or is the ocean bottom moving over the hot spot? Mm-hmm. The answer appears to be both. It's just like everything in biology. You ask, is it this or this? No, it's actually both. And so there are reasons for it that I can explain, but they don't understand the source of these things. They don't understand the heating of them that's driving them. Obviously, there's something going on that's providing some local source of heating. Maybe it's just some complicated turbulence phenomenon. And then there are things like layers, LLSVP, large, low velocity, shear. Shear velocity provinces. So there are large sections of the Earth where there are what they say anomalously low velocities, and these are probably a lot of extra silicates. The silicates, the more the silicate, the lower the velocity. I better keep an eye on the time here. I better not get into this too much. Okay, and super plumes and piles. There are lots of names. Okay, so this is just giving you an idea of the kind of different models that exist with respect to just the chondritic Earth. There are the chondrites that we usually talk about. There are also things called ensitite chondrites, and that has a difference between having more oxygen in the earth early on or not. It turns out that uranium and thorium are elements. I think probably every physicist here would say uranium thorium is probably dissolved in the core of the earth, right? Another metal, why doesn't it go in solution? Answer, no, turns out that these chemicals are lithophiles, as they say, and they like to form compounds that actually float up in the silicaceous earth. And so the uranium thorium tends to come to the top. You all know about slag. You've seen this. Everybody knows about how you make iron, and so you cook it up, and this stuff floats to the surface, and you wind up getting pure iron underneath or copper. And that is apparently the case with the uranium-thorium. According to all the measurements that the geologists have made and even made them under pressure, I'm always a little suspicious, because how do you get the pressures and temperatures in the middle of the Earth experimentally? Mostly it's in diamond anvils, in about 1 cubic meter that they can heat and put the pressure on, and it's a little hard to believe that they really know the equation of state, but they say they do. And everybody pretty much agrees, except some of the people who are in favor of an ENSTA-type chondrite dominated earlier, that which could have some of the uranium thorium staying down, that the uranium thorium is mostly up. And the general belief is that, in fact, about half the uranium thorium is in this little crust out here, and the other half in the mantle. So it's mostly actually come out. But, you know, this is the fire, this is having the fire on top of the stove doesn't help you to circulate the stuff downstairs. The question is, where is the heat under the... It's another kind of chondrite that has different, has more oxygen in it, basically. So these are people you wouldn't know. I think all I really want to try to say here is that there are significant academic disputes, and there's a big difference in the proposed compositions from these different models.
And this is like dark matter.
yeah. It looks a little familiar in this spot, right?
and the slide before.
Right. This is dark energy. This is dark matter. But this is where the Earth's heat flow is expected to come from. So I need to say a little bit about the heat flow. How do you get the Earth's heat flow? You go around with a thermometer? No. You have to go around and you have to drill wells and measure the gradient of heat in the well and measure the thermal conductivity of the material to look at the gradient and therefore deduce the heat flow. That is not easy to do in the middle of the ocean. And especially a big controversy has to do with, you've all seen the pictures of the black smokers and so on in the middle, particularly around the Mid-Atlantic Ridge and so on. These places where hot water that's relatively black with sulfides is streaming out with a lot of heat. So you can imagine that buggers up all your calculations about the heat flow, right? So there's much ambiguity and more arguing about how much heat is emitted around these mid-ocean ridges and so on. So you actually need a fairly sophisticated model of the Earth to calculate this number of measured heat flow at 46 plus or minus 3 terawatts. I've seen it quoted a lot of different numbers, and there's one rebel group that says that it's actually, because of the mid-ocean business, says it's actually 35 plus or minus 2 terawatts.
So what is this radiogenic heat and cooling? So what are these two numbers? R star is radiogenic.
Oh, so I'm going to tell you the others. The others are the inferred sources of these. So I was telling you about what we measure from the Earth. That's a more or less solid number. The others, then, we need to do some modeling and understanding. And here's what people standardly get. What?
So what are these error bars?
This is a sore subject.
Why two of them have error bar? One is pure number and one has tilde.
Yeah. This is geology. This is geology.
But see, there is radioactive reaction going on. So it gives us some heat, we understand that.
Yes, but you need to know.
What is this cooling means, yes, scientifically? What does that cooling mean?
The cooling, okay. Yeah. Now, so I'll tell you what these different things are. And so first of all, the crust. This is the one we probably really do know, because we can get our hands on the crust. You can't go down deeper than around 20 kilometers with a drill or your drill melts. So, but they're up thrusts and so on, so you can infer the composition, and they're pretty good models. You'll see more about this in a bit. The mantle cooling is by calculation, and I have another slide. Next slide that explains
more. What in the air for the crust, which you can actually measure, and then you have less in percentage.
Yes, these are systematic errors on the measurements. And I'll show you some slides to show you why this is problematic. The mantle R value that they quote, R means the amount of radiogenic heating, and it's based this is sort of the standard model, McDonough and Son, of the BSC faults that look at Earth. And they get 20 plus or minus 4 for the sum of this and this. And then there's the mantle and core, and those are by calculation, and so is the tidal dissipation. That'll help if I go on to this a little bit. Here is a temporal display of the contents of these major radioactive elements in the Earth as a function of time, pointing out a significant problem that nobody really understands.
So this is billion years on that side.
Yes, yes.
So what does giga mean?
Giga annum. We're very academic. So, so this is just the decay. These are just the decay of these things. These dominant radioactive elements are the ones that have long lifetimes. The shorter ones are all gone. But I'll show you again in a little bit. These are the source of the decay chain. There's many, many, many steps in the decay chain, but all of those have relatively short lifetimes. So you only really need to think about the primary source of this. The interesting one here is U-235, because as you know, if you get a bunch of U-235 together, you can have something exciting happen. And apparently it did happen 2 billion years ago in Africa at a place called the Oklo reactors, where there were natural reactors cooking at the surface of the Earth. But you can't do it anymore because we're out here. U-235 is near gone. Although there's this one guy by the name of Herndon who's been making a lot of noise over the years, but generally discredited, claiming that there are natural reactors cooking in the Earth that are breeder reactors.
He wants
most geologists completely dismissing.
He wants it in the core.
He wants it in the core, yeah.
So this thing,
but there are others that propose that there's cooking going on at the CMB, which is a little more credible.
So it happened in Africa 2 billion years ago. There are geological evidence on the surface now.
Right, right. And they found, it was discovered, the French were digging uranium for making whatever they make, and they noticed some funny isotope ratios and traced it back and found this region where not just one, but there were a few natural reactors. But the separation of the elements was a process involving water, which another whole story, but water can be an interesting influence in a lot of
things. So we can say that Africans knew about the fusion reactor.
Well, this was a little before there was anybody walking around there by about 2 billion years. So potassium-40 is interesting as well. But you see, these guys here dropped off very strongly with time. You say, yeah, so what? The so what is that the heat from the Earth has decreased very significantly over time, and yet the geological evidence for the magnetic field is that it's been more or less constant for billions of years. So if you want to say that the heating in the outer core is driven by the radioactive decays, you have a problem. And there are some people, so many things to talk about. There's an interesting discontinuity in the communities. There's the geophysicists and the geochemists, and they don't talk to each other too much. This first big meeting we had in Hawaii, there were some of the big shots in the field, was honest to God, the first time they said that they'd been in a meeting together. So there was an interesting exchange, more than just physicists to geologists talking.
So today, but the maximum amount of heating is coming either from thorium or uranium-238.
Yeah. So potassium is very interesting too. Potassium has different chemistry, and potassium is a potassium is amongst the lighter elements that are more likely to escape. And so there's questions about how much potassium there really is in the Earth. And where is it? It's in a different place for sure than the uranium thorium. And so some people, there's one guy, one fellow from Minnesota who was long pushing that there was potassium in the Earth's core. Most geologists dismiss that. It sounds like an attractive idea to me. So the potassium, it's the potassium 40 decay, which you all have. You all have lots inside of you. Mm-hmm. These 40 decays per kilogram per second, I think, in seawater, like you.
So what is the heat source of the core?
Well, that's the good question. We don't really know.
But this is related to the magnetic field too. Yeah.
Well, yes, because so you would think it'd be nice to have heat right here, and there is some heat there, which is that the heat of crystallization. But that's not apparently enough. I know the guy who's one of the big shots in doing this business at Johns Hopkins does this modeling, and I have asked him, where do you get the heat in your model? Because he does sort of get the magnetic fields of this fancy hydrodynamic calculation, and the answer is that he puts it in. So do you put in a seed field too? Yeah. Okay. So I think there's a lot of mystery about
the Earth. Where is the maximum amount of uranium and thorium? We hear about the different countries, but that just in the outer few kilometers.
That's in the crust.
So most of them are in crust, and that's where we are getting the heat.
About half of it is in the crust, and half of it is in the mantle, in bulk. But the mantle is much bigger than the crust, so the density in the mantle is much, much less. But then the argument in the geologists is there a lot of it down around here? Is it all around inside here? Or is it layered and it's mostly here? There are reasons this circulating crust with the interaction with water, blah, 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 various, various fairy stories. Okay. Well,
what did you learn from looking us?
Yeah.
Yeah. Since it's 3 o'clock already, we should probably.
Yeah. Okay. There's a picture of a meteorite. Not a very good one. Just a comment about the meteorites. There's about a little more than 1,000 meteorites studied, and the ones that are that our friends like the most are these carbonaceous chondrites. So a number to remember is in the Earth, you were asking about the content, it's order of parts per billion, or the geologists always like to say nanograms per gram, which drives me wild. But parts per billion, much, much less than a part per billion in the core, they claim order of 20 parts per billion in the silicate part, and as you see, much, much more than that on the average in the continental crust.
It's 238?
Yeah, 238, the 235 is mostly gone. So this is what the spectra of neutrinos looks like. And so this is MeVs, 1, 2, 3. Reactor neutrinos are mostly like this, and the threshold for inverse beta decay is here. And you see that with the detectors that we have these days, the big detectors that are sensitive to inverse beta decay, like Camlin and Barcino, we measure the uranium and thorium. And to note here is that the thorium, and you see this isn't one radioactive species, right? This is a superposition. So here's the thorium, and then the uranium sticking out to somewhat higher energies.
So the backgrounds are gone, you said, because the reactors are off now. So shouldn't you?
Well, in Camlin.
In Camlin.
Yeah.
So shouldn't you get a very precise measurement then?
Well, it takes time. Mm-hmm. We only get one of these events every few days. It's a John, for patient people, this is a very truncated set of decay chains from uranium with the prime components shown at 2.3 and 3.3 MeV from the uranium chain and from the thorium chain. Protoactinium and actinium, I have no idea what those elements are. Bismuth, and finally winding up in lead.
When you measure these neutrinos, you are not able to distinguish them from where they are coming from.
No.
Just you.
If we
your
paper,
your first
one of the goals,
basically these are the geoneutrinos,
right?
Because you can go and you can look at the
right
subdirectionality with the.
Well, the directionality is a very interesting issue that I'd like to talk more about if I get a chance, because we're working on some techniques, but it's basically very, very hard to do directionality with these super low energy neutrinos. And nobody does it as of right now.
Decay or a different detection reaction.
That's it, baby.
Alright.
People talk about using coherent neutrino detectors. But they are pretty much worthless for that sort of thing. What?
It is the number and the spectrum. It is only the expected number and the spectrum by which you can say that they are geometry.
Yes, which I think I have a slide up here very shortly. I just wanted to show what we just sent a paper into neutrino into Nature Geosciences, where we made the definitive map of neutrinos of the world. So we'll be the proponents of the sources of that, and will become a standard if anybody cares. But this is the luminosity of neutrinos from the crust and mantle in watts. So the total luminosity of our neutrino star is only about 0.7 terawatts. Well, 700 gigawatts, that's pretty snappy. That's not the power in the heating, of course, that's a different story, right? Because most of the energy from the radioactive decays. Oh, a little point here for people who don't know. There's always confusion about how come the reactor neutrino spectrum is so much higher in energy than the natural decay spectrum? The answer is the natural decays are just bloody beta decays from these long-standing elements, mostly. There's some other stuff in there. Whereas the reactor spectrum is from fissions, and the fissions, then you get these elements that are way off the stable valley, and you can get much higher energies. And in fact, many of these elements, George Fuller isn't here, but he studies the R process, which tries to calculate the source of many of these heavy elements, most of which I believe have never been observed, because they're way up on the side of the stable valley. So the spectrum from the reactor goes to much higher energies than the natural decays.
So if you switch off the reactor, it would also drop in energy, right?
You bet.
We discussed it at some point
in
the Fukushima reactor, but you don't see very much.
And so this is a comparison. This is an idealized spectrum with some smearing introduced to it. This is 2-4 MeV, and with the thorium to uranium ratio of 4, another whole story there. The data seems to be suggesting that may not be quite right, which will be interesting if it pans out to the geologists. Closest reactor for this calculation of 1,000 kilometers away, but you can see where at Camland, where the nearer the reactor mean was 180 kilometers, so multiply this by like 25, and you see the geoneutrinos were a small background, but now this is more like the way it is in Camland right now, and something like the way it is in Borodino, because the nearest reactors there are in France. And this is what the measurements look like as a function of time. Our first measurement here in Camland and Borodino compared, and the meatballs are getting smaller. And this is what it looks like compared to expectations. The expectations are different for Gran Sasso in Japan because a lot of the flux is due to local products. You can imagine one over R squared is dominated by the local neutrinos. And that turns out to be very hard to estimate accurately. Some people say they do it to 10%. I think it's probably more like 20%, because it's just too hard to get the sampling down deep near.
What's the GNU?
Terrestrial neutrino unit, which is the number of counts per year per 10 to the 30th proton targets. Which is about 1,000 ton detector for a year.
What is the third block into Camlan, which is missing in Borexino?
Oh, it's just when they reported data. That's all. Huh? It's just when the data was reported.
Oh, okay.
That's all. So the takeaway from here is that
maybe the same for Nova.
Yeah, the takeaway from here is that they more or less agree with the expected models, but not with all models. Here are the three detectors that will be saying something in the near future, and at present, Camlan and Borexino and Snow hopefully will come on.
Maybe we should spend also some time on the physics questions. Like, for instance, can you measure the age of the Earth? Or like, what about the diffuse supernova background? Shouldn't that also be some kind of background on these kind of things?
Okay. Okay. This is what we've done to make maps, just to give you an idea. We use all kinds of models. There are models that people have of the crust and mantle and so on, and compound them. Turns out it's calculationally, it's not deep, but it's painful.
John, on the map of the Earth there, right up, why China is so hot?
That's Tibet. That's where India, it's you guys' fault. Bloody Indians crowding up underneath the Asians.
I know.
And so the crust is twice as thick in that.
So basically, when it came, the Gondwana land and fit into it, it created. Yeah. Okay, and that is what it's reflected in heat? What is it reflected?
Yeah, in the total heating and the total neutrino content.
So the first approximation was just the thickness, right, of the continental crust or not?
Just zero theory, yes. But then we made fairly detailed models and put those together and done all of this. Mm-hmm. And then
doesn't it seem more dense in the South Pole than in the North Pole? It should be the reverse. More air than blue.
Wow, that's a stupid projection. That's why that's a Mercator projection.
But why the hot things is there? So why more in the ocean floors? The ocean floors
are thin and they're young.
So
they don't have as much radioactivity.
They contain more.
They contain less.
Oh, this is hot.
So that blue is not colored because of ocean. It's colored blue because there's less radioactivity there. So if you really want to measure the mantle, this is why we say we need a deep ocean neutrino detector. You need to go out in the middle of the deep ocean.
And what is the red
are these places where there's a lot of uplift.
The yellow one.
This is a particular plot for the uranium distribution in the crust model.
Okay,
so this, just to give you an idea, there have to be inferences made. People have started making. The first models were all completely isotropic models, a spherical Earth. And then our friends are starting to get more sophisticated. They're starting to say, aha, we can try to do something because we know the velocities are different, and we can infer that. So here comes amphibolite facies and granulite facies. Granulite is more like granite, and it means just phases. And with these percentage of silicon weight, the velocity changes, so you can try to use the velocity which you measure to infer the composition, and then infer the uranium thorium that's in it from that, and then you can make some sort of a model. And that gets complicated. And we should skip over
to some kind of conclusion.
John, you want to say anything about the potassium chloride detection?
No, but this is a map of what the world looks like at different, the surface map in different energies. And this is the, this is dominated by potassium. So if you want to look for the K40, that's the one you use. And if you go to the higher energies up here, this includes the reactors. What you see is where the reactors are. So we have
the
maps.
Reactors are the brightest ones.
Yeah. So there's the world in rotating in neutrinos. This was to show you about the different models of what's going on in the mantle. And this is literally the kind of difference that people are dealing with. Models, as I was telling you, where a hot spot comes from down the CMB, or that it originates up higher at some sort of turbulence and all sorts of things. But now people are starting to make more models. These are these slow velocity regions, which you can infer something about content, and you can make models. And a first simplistic model of an asymmetric world looks like this, again by the same group of friends. And so this is something we could test by reactors at these different locations. And this location here is down in the South Pacific, where there's this huge volcanically active region and some kind of a big lump there.
But nobody is also knows. Somewhere in South America, or it is down much below us?
No. So that's what it looks like, the asymmetric Earth.
So I think we have to come to some kind of conclusion, because 315 is really a hard
one. Yeah. Okay. So what, there were a couple of questions, physics questions people wanted to hear answers to. What can we do with neutrino physics? The answer is not a lot. We've looked at neutrino oscillations, for example. How does that influence things? And the main neutrino oscillation for these Nui bars at these energies has a scale of about 110 kilometers. So that the first recovery of the first dip, which Juno was at the first dip, 55 kilometers. So 110 kilometers, it's back again. So can you do something with that to discern interesting details? So Steve Dye has made models with this, and the answer is not much. Now, if we had something like Herndon was promising, like localized sources, then we have some very nice ways to look for those, using correlation functions in with the shape of the oscillation pattern, and you slide across the spectrum. And you can pick out at a 1,000 kilometer scale, you can pick out the distance to a few kilometers. But that requires a point source that's strong enough to see, which we have no reason to believe is there.
So a simple question, if you put another reactor from Juno detector at 110 kilometers, which is quite large,
yes,
what is it going to give you?
Oh, I had another nice plot, but something I can show you guys privately, that in making these maps, we started seeing some very pretty things that we've seen in doing these studies of location of neutrinos, is you see these things that are sort of like interference rings around reactors. And we've been calling this, neutrino detection and ranging. Because if I have a detector here, if I have a detector here and I look at the spectrum, I can get, by using correlation functions and so on, I can get the range to a reactor here very well. And I can actually deconvolve it from another one here. But I don't know where these two guys are. If I have a little directionality, then I can sort them out. Or better yet, to speak to the question, if I have a second detector here, then we can sort them out. And so we have a huge physics report, 100 pages, with all kinds of figures. You can see how we can play this game to find hidden reactors and so on.
So I think we should probably finish here, or probably should have perhaps at some point some of physics discussion, and maybe we can also do so over coffee. But we're eating our cookies, so we have to hurry.
Right. So I'm happy to entertain any questions.
We cannot be stopped. cannot be there, given that not